Well, we're just about a day and a half away from the end of the year 2012, and there's one crucial piece of information I'm sure you're all dying to find out. Just what was the most searched for term on Google this year? Well, surprisingly, had nothing to do with the Olympics, had nothing to do with Kate Middleton's baby, or even Gangnam Style. It was just three short words, actually. What is love? And despite endless songs and TV programs and films on the subject of love, it seems people are still desperate to get to the heart of what love is really all about. And this afternoon, I want to suggest that John, in his second letter, is dealing with quite a similar question. What is love? And how do we love each other more as a church? And why do we need to? And thankfully, the answers he gives are far better than those offered by Google. So please do keep 2 John open in front of you as we go through the passage. Firstly, let's just have a think about who John was. John the Apostle, he's often called the Apostle of Love because his letters are so infused all the way through with the idea of love. And he's also referred to as the disciple Jesus loved because he had a particularly close relationship with Jesus. And one of the things that makes his letters so thrilling to read, I think, is that they're full of words which remind us so directly of things that Jesus himself said during his time on earth. And I'm sure we'll see that more and more as we go through the passage. So that's the author. What about the recipients of the letter? This is potentially a little bit more confusing. Just who was it being written to? In verse 1, John addresses the letter to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth. So it sounds a bit like John's writing to a woman that he knows and her children. But that would be slightly unusual in Bible times, so it seems a bit more likely that it's actually a way of speaking about a church. John would have been an elder in another church, a sister church, if you like. That's implied in verse 13. And the children would be the congregations of each church. But whatever the exact details, John clearly knew at least some of those he was writing to, and he cared deeply for them. And perhaps for that reason, for us as modern readers to study this letter, can feel a little bit like eavesdropping on a personal conversation. Feels a bit intimate, a bit personal. But I'm sure that's not what John intended at all. At least he didn't intend it to be private. In verse 1, he involves the universal church in his message by stating that it's not only himself that loves the church to whom he's writing, but also all who know the truth. In other words, all Christians. So even in the first verse of his letter, John is setting up this idea that truth and love go together. Truth and love cannot be separated. And that's the first kind of big point I'd like you to take away from this passage. Truth and love can't be separated. John's attitude was that you didn't need to know someone intimately or even at all for you to love them. Instead, we should love other Christians simply because of the fact that we are united to them through Jesus Christ. And through knowing the truth. But what does it mean to know the truth? Is it simply sort of ticking off the mental boxes in your head and saying, you know, I believe this about God, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, the Bible, sin, salvation, etc., etc.? Well, no, I think knowing the truth is more than that. It does include that, but it's more than that. When John speaks about knowing the truth, and in verse 2, that the truth abides in us and will be with us forever, we're reminded of some of what John wrote in his gospel. In John chapter 14, verse 6, John records Jesus as saying, I am the way and the truth and the life. Jesus says, I am the truth. If you want to see truth, look at me. And so as Christians, we can say we know the truth in at least two ways. Firstly, we do know what is true and what is false through God's revelation to us in the Bible. Secondly, we know through God's grace, the one who is truth personified, Jesus Christ. And the reason I think that's important is it shows us truth is personal. Truth isn't a sterile concept that can be detached from real life, analysed under a microscope. Knowing the truth will affect the way we live, and it will affect our relationships with others in major ways. It will affect how we love others. So we mustn't view truth and love as two separate ideas. They're actually two sides of the same coin. Now, of course, it is possible to be truthful without being loving. You only have to think of someone like Simon Cowell when he was on X Factor. You couldn't accuse him of being dishonest, but there wasn't much love for those he kind of tore into. The point is, that should never happen within the church. And the trap we fall into, though, I think the danger for us is the opposite. We think we can be loving without being truthful. And this sort of person is a bit more like your granny than Simon Cowell. They're the sort of person who will never criticise you, no matter what you do. But why is that attitude wrong? It sounds really nice, doesn't it? In fact, we sometimes call that kind of idea, wrongly, unconditional love. But actually, it's not loving to only ever give someone praise and never a warning. Because we're all sinful human beings, and we might well need a good dose of truth every now and again to stop us going down the wrong track, put us back on the right track, and stop us from stumbling blindly into trouble and danger. If a friend said to you that they never speak truthfully to their children because they love them too much, you'd know something was wrong there. And if that applies to us as individuals and as families, it applies just as much to us as a church. Because there are churches who will, in effect, say things like, our church is all about love. It doesn't really matter what you think the truth is. We're all about loving, not judging. But truth and love aren't polar opposites. They encourage one another. If you want a plant to grow strong and healthy, you wouldn't put it in a cupboard where there's no sunlight, but say, oh, it's okay, I've given it loads of water. And neither would you put it on the windowsill where there's loads of sunlight, but not water it. So in the same way, for a church to grow strong and healthy, a commitment to both truth and love is needed, and Christ Church Derby should be a church full of both truth and love. So now that we've got this grounding in the idea that truth and love go together and can't be separated, what practical implications might this have for us as a church? John gets more and more practical as we go through this letter, and this brings me on to my next big point. Obey the command to love one another. Obey the command to love one another. This is verses 4 to 6. Now, the explicit command in this part of the letter is there at the end of verse 5, that we are to love one another. Sounds quite simple and straightforward, doesn't it? But actually, of course, in reality, it's much harder to do that. It's very hard to put that command into practice. It's not an automatic thing to do. Otherwise, John wouldn't feel the need to write to this church in the first place and remind them to do it. And in verse 4, John says that only some of the church are walking in the truth. Only some of them were loving each other as they should, not all of them. Now, the flow of verses 4 to 6 is potentially a little bit confusing for us. So think of it like a sandwich, with 4 and 6 being the bread, and verse 5 is the meat. In verses 4 and 6, John reminds his readers how important it is that, and always has been, in fact, to obey God's commands. And loving one another, he says, isn't a new commandment. John says it's one that they've had from the beginning. By the beginning, John might well be referring to the Last Supper, where Jesus did describe this command as a new command, and it was new then in the sense of the motivation the disciples had for loving one another. They were about to see the ultimate demonstration of love as Jesus died for them and gave himself for them on the cross. And it was a new context in that the church was about to be born. However, in another sense, the idea of love as part of the commands of God goes back at least as far as the law of Moses in the Old Testament. We often think of obeying commands and law as being far removed from the idea of love. But that's not how the Bible sees it at all. The way the Bible sees it is that obedience to the commands flows out of love for the one giving the commands, God himself. When Jesus was asked which were the greatest commandments, he responded with two commandments that were all about love, essentially. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and you shall love your neighbour as yourself. They sum up the law, he said. So John is being thoroughly kind of biblical, if you like, here, when he focuses on love as being the primary way in which we obey God's commands. And I think actually this way of thinking about love as obedience, or rather obedience as love, solves a whole host of problems. Firstly, it shows us that when John speaks about loving one another, he doesn't necessarily expect that to be shown through really strong emotions towards one another. We can be loving towards every member of our church family, even if we don't know them particularly well, even if we don't naturally get on with them that well. Of course, it's great to have warm feelings of affection towards fellow church members. I'm not saying we shouldn't aim to build those. Of course we should. And I'm sure there are many of those kinds of relationships within Christchurch. Even in the sort of 4 months I've been here, I've seen an awful lot of loving relationships within Christchurch. But even if we don't have those kinds of feelings towards one another, towards everyone in church, or we don't yet, we can still love one another through keeping God's commands. Secondly, love as obedience avoids any of the vagueness of what exactly it might mean to love one another. Because people can mean all sorts of things when they say love one another, can't they? But the wonderfully liberating thing about God's commands is that they are designed to produce loving relationships within God's people if they are properly kept. So if you think of a commandment God gives in the Old Testament, do not covet, for example, we see that not coveting will be a loving way to act towards our fellow church members. So to give a practical example, say you're a single person and you'd really love to get married one day, and then you find out someone else in Christchurch is getting married. Well, what's the loving thing to do in that situation? Would it be loving to be envious and resentful of their relationship, in other words, coveting their relationship, which would probably affect the way you speak to them and the way you speak about them to others? Or would it be loving to rejoice with them and share in their happiness? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? God's command not to covet shows you how to love that person in that situation. And there are many other examples we could think of. So, obey the command to love one another. It's time to move on to my final point. Abide in the teaching of Christ. Abide in the teaching of Christ. Just why is John so concerned that we love one another through keeping God's commands? Well, he's about to spell it out from verse 7 onwards. But again, these verses are very much connected to what's gone before, so don't think of it as something separate. Just allow me to read from verse 6 and see if you can spot what connects verse 6 with 7. And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you've heard from the beginning, so that you should walk in it. For, or we could say because, many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. There were obviously many false teachers around in John's day, and we'd be naive to think that there aren't also many false teachers around today as well. In John's day, the false teachers he was particularly concerned about claimed that Jesus Christ had not come in the flesh. That's at the end of verse 7. What does that mean? Well, I think it means they accepted that Jesus was fully God, but not that he was fully human. And to our minds, that seems like a slightly odd, strange heresy to believe. We expect people to believe that Jesus was a real man. We don't necessarily expect people to believe that he was God. And we might even go so far as to be tempted to believe that as long as someone believes Jesus is God, it doesn't matter whether they think he was a man or not. But actually, it does matter hugely that we hold to the truth that Jesus was a real human being, as well as being really God. The false teachers claim that Jesus didn't really suffer. He didn't really weep over the death of his friend Lazarus. He didn't really get hungry or thirsty or tired. And most crucially of all, he didn't really die on the cross. He just sort of appeared to. He wasn't a real man, he just sort of appeared to be. So you can see how the whole gospel starts to unravel if you believe that lie, and that was why John was so keen to warn his readers against believing this false teaching. Now, although it's by no means the main point of the passage at all, I think it is worth just saying a few words about the use of this term Antichrist in verse 7, because there's no doubt that it kind of jumps off the page in a way that few other words do, and it has many connotations in our culture, most of which are probably pretty unhelpful. When John uses the word Antichrist, he simply means someone who is fundamentally opposed to Jesus Christ and his teaching and his truth, even if they claim to be on his side, even if they're claiming to be a Christian. It's not just one individual, John makes clear. He says that many such people have gone out into the world. It's certainly not some kind of supernatural individual. So it's strong language, certainly, but it is necessary to make clear to us just how serious this false teaching is. In fact, it's so serious that in verse 8, John explains that if they do follow the false teachers, they run the risk of throwing away everything that they've come to enjoy as Christians. And therefore, the obvious application for the original readers of the letter back then, and also for us today, is first and foremost to watch ourselves so we don't slip into false ways of thinking. These ideas are actually around more in our modern culture than we might realise. One modern expression of this kind of false teaching which John was dealing with is called the prosperity gospel. The idea of the prosperity gospel is basically that true Christian experience should never involve suffering in any way. Basically, if you have enough faith, you should always be healthy and wealthy and happy in life. And it's a very popular idea today. It's all over the God Channel and things like that. But it's completely false. Christians can expect to suffer in this life, just as Jesus has suffered before us. And that prosperity gospel can trace its roots back to these kinds of false teachers who claim that Jesus didn't really suffer as a real human being. And you can see how it's a short jump to believe that we shouldn't suffer either as Christians. But what's even worse about this is to teach that Jesus didn't suffer removes a huge part of the comfort we can have when we're going through hard times and suffering as Christians. I'm sure many of us have had that experience where you're going through a really hard time, suffering in some way, and then you read something in the Bible, or maybe a Christian friend reminds you, or you listen to a sermon, and you're reminded of how Jesus himself suffered during his life. And if Jesus himself suffered, then it reminds us that he knows what it's like, he's been where we are, and he knows what we're going through and he can help us. If Jesus didn't suffer, then he seems so much more distant. He can't relate to us. So we need to watch ourselves. We don't fall for this false teaching today, mainly because it is simply false. It's not honouring to God to believe things that are false, but also because it will rob us of so much comfort if we fall for it. So that's the first kind of instruction, watch yourselves. The second instruction on how to deal with these false teachers is to reject them outright. In verses 10 and 11, John is very clear that they should have nothing to do with them at all. It's just not worth getting involved, he says. And it's deadly serious, because as John says in verse 9, if we don't abide in the teaching of Christ, we don't have God. And actually, it's not a coincidence that John picks up on this particular false teaching in the middle of a letter that's about loving our fellow Christians. It might seem a bit odd, but actually it's very much connected. Because the false teachers that John was so concerned about and that he confronts here were ultimately denying God's real sacrificial love for his people. They were actually denying the message of Christmas. They were saying that God wouldn't really become a man in order to save us. It might look like he had, but God wouldn't really be born of a virgin. He wouldn't really kind of grow up to teach and perform amazing miracles, to really die and really be raised to life, all as a real human being, whilst remaining God. But the amazing news that we've been thinking about at Christmas, and every Christmas I hope, is that God did enter into our messy, sinful world in which we live, and he came in order to save us. God didn't just sit back in heaven and make very general, nice-sounding comments and statements about how much he loves the world. Whenever you read a statement about how much he loves the world in the Bible, it's always related to something he did. God so loved the world that he sent his only son. God didn't just sit back and make the statement. He took action. He did something. He sent his son to become a man without ceasing to be fully God. And he rolled his sleeves up, as it were, and got his hands dirty and involved himself in our world, and ultimately died for us, all because he loves us so much. So how will believing this truth about Jesus being fully God and fully man make any difference to our love for one another? Well, if we think about it, it can be very easy for us to have a kind of general, non-specific love for other Christians. There's no test there. The test comes when we're asked to love real, specific, named individuals that we know personally, especially since we're all sinful people, None of us are perfect, and we're going to let each other down from time to time. We can be extremely difficult to love sometimes. But it's not enough to be a kind of detached well-wisher for others in church. Instead, we need to be people that are willing to roll our sleeves up, get involved, and encourage one another in the truth. So, say someone at Christchurch lets you down again, they lie to you, they don't turn up for their slot on the rota. What are you going to do? Just think about what the loving response to that would be. When someone needs yet another lift to the airport or another evening's babysitting, how are you going to react? Well, have a think about God's love for you, what he's done for you. Despite the fact that you, along with everyone else here, we've treated God terribly. We don't deserve his love. Does God give up on us when we fail him for the 20,000th time this year? Well, no. Does he withhold his love because we continually mess up and let him down? No. So neither should we withhold our love from others, our brothers and sisters in Christ, especially those in church. Instead, we need to roll our sleeves up and get involved in loving service of one another. What about if you're not a Christian here today? I wonder what you've made of this passage as we've gone through. What do you make of John's quite specific insistence on the primacy of knowing and believing these details about who Jesus is? Perhaps it seems a bit overly dogmatic. Why not be a little bit more open to different points of view on the subject? Maybe it's this sort of thing which kind of puts you off Christianity and becoming a Christian at all. It just seems a bit too certain, a bit too arrogant, narrow-minded, or bigoted even. But do you see how John's ultimate concern here is love? That doesn't diminish the importance of holding to the truth. It highlights even more how crucial it is that we do hold to the truth. Because we're not dealing here with trivial things where it doesn't really matter what you think. If we do today what the false teachers back in John's day did and essentially recreate God to be a little bit more palatable, a little bit more acceptable to the way we want him to be, rather than accepting him for who he truly is, then we have no God at all. And to do that is a serious mistake, and John doesn't want anyone to go down that road. The reality is that the truest, highest, purest form of love is to be found in God rather than in relationships of our own making, which, although good, will always contain elements of sin and selfishness. But God's love is self-giving, sacrificial, and selfless. And when we come to understand that love rightly, that will also have a huge impact on our relationships with others. So can I ask you, do you know that love? Well, I'd like to finish by just asking you to turn in your Bibles to John's Gospel, chapter 15, which I think is on page 1087 of the church Bibles. I'm just going to read a short section starting at verse 5. And don't worry, I'm not going to go into a full-length exposition of this passage. But I just think it'll be really helpful as we finish just to think about some of the some of what it says. And I think it'll be fairly self-explanatory because there's so much overlap between 2 John that we've just been reading and this passage in John 15. So I'm just going to start to read from verse 5 and see if you can spot some similarities to what we've been thinking about it. So this is Jesus himself speaking just a few hours before he's going to be betrayed and arrested and crucified. So Jesus said, verse 5, "I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers, and the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. Well, God never asks us to do something that he hasn't himself done first. He has given us the greatest example of love by laying down his life for his people in the person of Jesus Christ. So let us love one another with the same love that Jesus has for us.